Our headlines. The United Nations resumes its humanitarian flights to Afghanistan more than 2 weeks after the Taliban takeover. The Syrian military says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli missile attack, intercepting most of the missiles over the capital, Damascus. Also, at least six people are injured in what New Zealand's prime minister has described as a Daesh-inspired terrorist stabbing attack. Hello and welcome to your world news coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the United Nations has resumed its humanitarian flights to northern and southern Afghanistan more than 2 weeks after the Taliban takeover. A UN spokesperson says the flights will enable scores of humanitarian organizations to continue life-saving activities in Afghanistan. The current flights link Pakistan's capital with the city of Mazar-Sharif in northern Afghanistan and Kandahar in the south. Three flights have already landed in Mazar-e-Sharif this week. The UN says efforts are underway to launch more flights and to more destinations. It says work is also underway to transport non-food items, such as medical supplies. The UN has previously warned of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan, where half of the population depends on aid. Hello and welcome to another edition of News Review. Thank you for joining us. The U.S. Treasury Department says Washington has not reduced sanctions pressure on Taliban leaders. The Treasury says significant restrictions on Taliban access to the international financial system remains in place. Experts believe, in line with that policy, billions in Afghan assets parked in the U.S. will remain frozen for months. Last month, the International Monetary Fund blocked the Taliban from accessing some $440 million in new emergency reserves. Humanitarian groups have warned that the cost may be the collapse of Afghanistan's economy. Food and fuel prices are already soaring there amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by a halt in dollar shipments. In order to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Einar Tangen. He is an author and columnist joining us out of Beijing. And also Tim Kirby, he is an analyst for the Strategic Culture Foundation, joining us out of Moscow. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining this edition of News Review. Now, my first question is actually one for both of you, gentlemen. The former government, having strong strategic ties to the U.S., understandably had billions of dollars in their U.S. accounts. And now, with this blocking order, the Taliban will lose access to that money. How does this affect the Taliban and also Afghanistan's economy? Let me just first start with Einar Tangen, joining us out of Beijing.
All right. There are a number of issues that have to be considered. One is legitimacy. I mean, there has not been a formal handover of power. There needs to be recognition. These are the kind of bureaucratic details that the U.S. Intends to use as a as a way of kind of putting more pressure on the Taliban. Remember, if it was the Afghan government, in theory, Ghani is still the president. He could have tried to grab some of that cash. I don't think the U.S. would have let him, but that's in theory where things are. But it comes down to two points, leverage and then possible trying to create destabilization in the area. And leverage, I mean, the U.S., Biden has promised that he's going to bring home more Americans, more Afghans, etc. I think this is going to be one of their main pressure points, is this financial side. The other thing is, if the U.S. isn't happy, it'll be quite obvious that they will just withhold the money entirely. In that case, it causes a huge economic and humanitarian catastrophe in the area that the neighbors, Russia, China, and the surrounding neighbors in the stands will have to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Tangen. Now let's cross over to Moscow and let's hear Mr. Tim Kirby's thoughts on this.
Well, the real issue is that I think this is a very, these Neuters articles about this being cut off from these funds, they make it seem like it's the and-all be-all, which is a very, again, Washington looking at the world through Washington's lens, because the Taliban already really has the major wealth driver. They have the land. Because governments derive their wealth from the land and the population, And that's basically what the Taliban has control of now. I think they'll be able to live without $10 billion locked away somewhere. There are certain countries, like the one that you're sitting in, that have dealt very well with being cut off from international banking. So this is really not that big of a road bump. We should also not forget that what is happening in Afghanistan is essentially a revolution, a sort of strange revolution where the one side sort of abdicated before the revolution even started. But in a post-revolutionary phase, the economy is always terrible. Revolutionary Russia, if we look at the early years after the Cuban Revolution, the French Revolution, these are always times of great change, and great change tends to be very violent and economically disastrous. So to think that the Taliban is somehow trying to create a massive cultural governmental change of the country and yet somehow do this ideally without one person suffering, it's impossible. That has never happened in human history, not once.
Now, Mr. Tangen, what does the U.S. want to achieve by this, blocking order?
Well, as I said, it's leverage. They want to use this to say that they have somehow controlled the situation. Biden has a narrative that he needs to spin, which says that, oh, yes, it doesn't matter. We have a hold over the Taliban because of this money. I disagree with my colleague. I do think this $10 billion is a very vital lifeline. Unfortunately, I would not expect that the U.S. government will be forthcoming with much, if any of it, for quite some period of time. You might say that land equals wealth, but you're talking about a nation that has been riven by war for the last 20 years with the U.S. and before that with Russia. And at this point, they are dealing with a broken economy, a drought, food insecurity, rising prices. And you can say, well, these things happen, but the fact is, if they do happen, it could spread instability throughout the region. And that's what the neighbors, especially China and I believe Russia and the rest of the neighbors, are concerned about.
All right, thank you. Now, Tim Kirby, how do you think the Taliban will find a way to kind of outmaneuver this blocking order?
Well, they essentially waited out. That's probably the most simple decision. They have the country, they sort of have the intellectual momentum, and if we look at what they've done in Kabul so far, they don't take kindly to much disagreeing factors with them. So we should see that probably in the next few years, again, in typical revolutionary fashion, there's going to be a lot of continued crackdowns on the people who supported the United States or who will try to support some other new upcoming changes in society. And so it's going to be this sort of traditional post-revolutionary phase probably for the next 5 years. After that, the population might start to slowly demand more. But for now, the chaos definitely the clock is on the Taliban's side of things.
And Mr. Tangen, from a humanitarian point of view, how do you think the U.S. can justify the blocking orders? Because, during its 20 years of military presence in Afghanistan, that only left the lives of, so many civilians actually lost their lives during their military presence. And now with their hasty withdrawal of forces, again, the chaos erupted and so many people again lost their lives in Afghanistan. So how can they justify this blocking order now?
Well, humanitarian is a word that is often used, but it's not actually practiced. The U.S. Believes its humanitarian efforts should be aimed not at trying to help the Taliban rule Afghanistan, but simply to use this money as leverage to get out peoples, Americans and others, so that they can, quote, declare victory. Biden is, very, very focused on the upcoming midterm elections. He's running into already significant political friction, even within his own party, over a large part of his agenda. He is intent on, he believes that he has to solve America's domestic problems before he can even address the international ones. So you can talk about humanitarian issues, but this is just a thin veil that is in front of the real politic that the U.S. has pursued. in terms of those who've been killed. If the U.S. was concerned about humanitarian issues, they wouldn't have gone into Afghanistan in the first place.
Tim Kirby, your final thoughts?
I think that the situation, we should look back again. I've mentioned it twice before, but it bears repeating that this looks a lot like many situations. And if we look back to Russian history, I do happen to be sitting in Russia at the moment, especially right after the Russian Revolution, there was a situation with landholders and basically the system by which the Russian Empire got its food. The communists did not like it. They wanted to break that apart and change it. Did they see that that would cause mass starvation, especially across the south of the Soviet Union? They probably should have if they were smart. If they weren't smart, they were just maybe overzealous. Long story short, they didn't care. They did what they wanted to do, and the Soviet Union survived through that horrible crisis period for a long time. And that may be what's happening in Afghanistan. We cannot expect for the Taliban to be sitting around wanting to build Los Angeles-style roads and high-rise apartments that are pretty and plant palm trees everywhere. They're in a sort of ideological euphoria, and it's very hard to look at things from some sort of Western materialistic logic when they probably don't particularly care about that. They have their own objectives, and if some people have to suffer along the way, so be it.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. I've been talking to Einar Tangen. He is an author and columnist joining us out of Beijing, and also Tim Kirby. He is an analyst for the Strategic Culture Foundation joining us out of Moscow. Welcome back. Taliban sources say the group's co-founder and head of political office, Mullah Baradar, will lead the new government in Afghanistan. The sources also said Mullah Muhammad Yaqub, the son of late Taliban founder Mullah Omar, will join the government with a senior position. According to the sources, the deputy head of the Taliban's political office, Sher Muhammad Abbas Stanakzai, will take a high-ranking post as well. The Taliban were expected to unveil the new government on Friday, but AFP news agency, citing a group spokesman, said the announcement has been postponed until Saturday. The Taliban swept to power on August the 15th after taking control of Kabul and most of Afghanistan. It has pledged to form an inclusive government and respect human rights and women's freedom within Islamic law. Syrian air defenses have repelled another Israeli airstrikes on the country, shooting down a number of missiles near the capital, Damascus. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who gave us the details.
Army military source confirmed the attack, saying that about 1:26 a.m. local time, Israel carried out this attack. Its fighter jets fired missiles from the direction of southeast Beirut, Lebanon, attacking some positions around the Syrian capital, Damascus. The military source confirmed that air defenses were able to intercept and shoot down most of the enemy missiles, and damages were limited to material. No one got killed or injured, according to the Syrian military source. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General calling on that international body to take measures to prevent any future attacks by Israel, because this is an attack which is illegal against international law, the UN Charter, and also Syria's sovereignty. But so far, during all of those years of war, Israel has been attacking Syria. The international community remains silent. No measures have been taken so far in preventing such attacks.
Syria has called on international institutions to force Israel to stop violating the rights of the citizens in the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the plea in letters to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. The ministry also urged the institutions to intervene immediately to facilitate the return of Golan residents to their homes. Parts of the Golan Heights have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The international community, including the United Nations, recognizes Syria's sovereignty over the region. The deputy permanent representative of Iran to the United Nations has called for the adoption of a non-discriminatory approach to the elimination of chemical weapons. Zahra Ershadi said Tehran fully supports the Chemical Weapons Convention and demands global compliance with the treaty. She added that for the world to achieve that goal, Israel must join the convention immediately and without any preconditions. The Iranian envoy hailed Syria for its efforts to completely and quickly destroy its chemical weapons. She expressed regret over what she called the politicization of Syria's case by some countries. El-Shadi made the remarks during a UN session on developments in West Asia. Israeli troops have killed a Palestinian youth and injured 15 more near the buffer zone in the Gaza Strip on the sixth night of protests against the siege of the Palestinian territory. Palestinian Health Ministry said 26-year-old Ahmed Saleh died after Israeli forces shot him in the abdomen. The ministry added that there are five children among the injured. Three people have been killed and dozens of others wounded since the anti-Israeli protests began at the weekend. Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinians protesting against the Israeli blockade. Demonstrators say they will continue their protests until the regime lifts a siege. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air, land, and sea blockade since 2007. At least six people have been injured in what the authorities have called a terrorist attack in New Zealand's largest city, Auckland.
This afternoon at approximately 2:40 p.m., a violent extremist undertook a terrorist attack on innocent New Zealanders in the Newland Countdown in Auckland.
The Prime Minister said the attacker stabbed the victims in a supermarket and was immediately shot dead by the police. She said the attacker was a Sri Lankan national who had been in New Zealand for 10 years and was known to the police. Ardern called the attack hateful and said the attacker was inspired by the Daesh terrorist group. In March 2019, New Zealand witnessed its worst ever terror attack in Christchurch. There, a white supremacist shot dead more than 50 Muslim worshippers at a mosque.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب الله
يسون القرآن للذكر
فكر
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started the explanation of Surah Hujurat, which is 49th in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here is Ayah 6.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إن جاءكم فاسق بنبأ فتبينوا أن تصيبوا قوما بجهالة فتصبحوا على ما فعلتم نادمين.
O you who have faith, if an evildoer comes to you with a report, look carefully into it, lest you harm a people in ignorance, then be sorry for what you have done. As you might recall, in our explanation last Friday of the previous ayahs of Surah Hujurat, we said, true believers are full of reverence towards the Prophet and never show any disrespect to him in view of his lofty status as the appointee of God, blessed with the most perfect characteristics for guiding mankind towards salvation. We also said that Islam attaches high status to social codes of conduct to the extent that impoliteness, including the disturbing of the peace of others with loud voices, is considered as a sign of lack of reasoning. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that we should not accept at face value any report that we receive, especially the account conveyed by a person not known to be sincere. Even in important matters such as intelligence, any report received from an evildoer should not be accepted unless investigated for its veracity, in order to avoid embarrassment and the taking of wrong decisions that may prove disastrous. This same rule applies to issue of religion and the circulation of hadith attributed to the Prophet. Here, the science of rijal plays the vital role of checking the authenticity of the narration by properly scrutinizing the background and characteristics of the transmitter, who might be a person of weak faith and weak memory, or an evildoer deliberately fabricating a hadith. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, a true believer never accepts at face value any report in any field, including social matters, economy, political issues, intelligence gathering, and even hadith that are attributed to the Prophet, unless these are properly checked. Number two, some persons and news agencies disseminate fake news to cause chaos in society. Hence, we should be alert and careful by sifting truth from falsehood. Number three, if decisions on the basis of hearsay can cause social embarrassment and political disasters, the acceptance of hadith narrated by weak transmitters and charlatans destroys the faith. Now we listen to ayahs 7 and 8 of this surah.
وَاعْلَمُوا أَنَّ فِيكُمْ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ لَوْ يُطِيعُكُمْ فِي كَثِيرٍ مِّنَ الْأَمْرِ لَعَنِتُّمْ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ حَبَّبَ إِلَيْكُمُ الْإِيمَانَ وَزَيَّنَهُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ وَكَرَّهَ إِلَيْكُمُ الْكُفْرَ وَالْفُسُوقَ وَالْعِصْيَانَ أولئك هم الراشدون فضلا من الله ونعمة والله عليم حكيم.
And know that among you is Allah's Prophet. Should he obey you in many a matter, you would surely fall into distress. But Allah has endeared the faith to you and has made it seemly in your hearts. And he has made hateful to you unbelief and transgression and disobedience. These it is that are the followers of a right way. By grace from Allah and as a favor. And Allah is knowing, wise. These two ayahs refer to two great blessings of God, namely sending of messengers for guidance of mankind and the innate nature granted to every human being to enable them to obey the Prophet. An important point to note here is that if the Prophet consults his friends and companions, this does not necessarily bind him to follow their advice, since whatever the Prophet says, acts, and commands is completely based on divine commandment as testified by the opening ayahs of Surah Najm. Thus, if people were to force their representatives of God to act according to their ways, they themselves will fall into distress, while those who, by the grace of God, have safeguarded their innate nature by abhorring all evil ways and by strictly adhering to the Prophet's path, these are indeed the successful ones. From these ayahs we'll learn that, number one, we should obey the divine messengers in order to build a sound, healthy, and virtuous society. And number two, it is the grace of God that inculcates in our hearts attraction towards all good things, including religious teachings and spiritual values, while at the same time prevents our hearts from indulging in evil and indecent ways. Now let us listen to Ayah 9 of Surah Hujurat as the concluding ayah of this episode.
وَإِن طَائِفَتَانِ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ اقْتَتَلُوا فَأَصْلِحُوا بَيْنَهُمَا فَإِن بَغَتْ إِحْدَاهُمَا عَلَى الْأُخْرَى فَقَاتِلُوا الَّتِي تَبْغِي حَتَّى تَفِيءَ إِلَى أَمْرِ اللَّهِ فَإِن فَاءَتْ فَأَصْلِحُوا بَيْنَهُمَا بِالْعَدْلِ وَأَقْسِطُوا إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُقْسِطِينَ.
And if two parties of the believers quarrel, make peace between them. But if one of them acts wrongfully towards the other, fight that which acts wrongfully until it returns to Allah's command. Then, if it returns, make peace between them with justice and act equitably. Surely Allah loves those who act equitably. This ayah points to another social ill, saying, sometimes there are clashes among individuals or groups of society. It is natural for each party to seek help from their friends. The Noble Quran stresses that fellow Muslims ought not to be mere onlookers in such cases, but should mediate peace between the conflicting groups. If one of the groups insists on fighting and does not submit to peace in violation of God's commandments for justice, then all are duty-bound to confront such a refractory group. This ayah teaches us that, number one, everyone is responsible toward the peace, stability, and security of society. Hence, in the time of conflicts, they cannot be indifferent and should strive to make peace. And number two, rebellious people damage social security and should be stopped from their evil ways, even if it leads to fighting and loss of life.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Israeli regime has swept into many areas, arresting young Palestinians because they are the most active in resisting Israeli occupation. Many of the youths who were arrested have received harsh sentences of 25 years in jail. Some are facing life. Others have not been charged but are still languishing away in jail. This is human rights, Israeli style. We've earlier talked to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, and she shed some light on Israel's crackdown on Palestinians. Let's take a listen at what she had to say.
We are speaking about 1,900 Palestinians were arrested in Al-Quds, dozens of them. We are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian minors. Dozens of those 1,900 are under the age of 14. It's against all international laws, according to Palestinian human rights as well as international human rights. So it's an attempt to intimidate them as well as to prevent any Palestinian to be engaged in the different forms of resistance, struggle, or activities against the Israeli occupation. In addition to those arrests, since the beginning of 2021, Palestinian Human Rights said that all over the occupied West Bank, 1,000 Palestinian minors were detained by the Israeli forces. 130 Palestinian women were detained by the Israeli soldiers across the occupied territories. This brings the number of Palestinians who are still languishing in the Israeli jails of over 4,500 Palestinians, because the Israeli forces, the Israeli authorities, use the policy that's known as the revolving door. So at the time they release Palestinians who end their terms in Israeli jails, every day they storm and raid Palestinian areas to continue arresting more Palestinians across the occupied territories.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajere out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us here on the spotlight. Well, let's start this off with Mick. Israel embarks on night raids of villages trying to cause as much fear and confusion as possible for Palestinians. They arrest young adults and many times even children and hold them without even charging them. I mean, what does all of this mean, that nothing is being done against this?
Well, your question contains the answer. The whole point is to instill fear and to terrorize the captive population of the West Bank. There was actually a group of quite prominent Zionist lawyers went to the West Bank a couple of years ago from London, very prestigious, big names, too expensive for me to be able to hire. And they came back absolutely shocked and stunned. And they said, look, this system is not a legal system at all. There's a 99.7% conviction rate. The whole purpose is to instill fear and terror into the Palestinian people, to demoralize and crush them. That is my view, but I'm talking about the views of a group of Zionist high-flying lawyers who went there and came back and could not ignore that truth. The Israelis have a very big toolbox. One is jailing people. And as I say, the system they have is 99.7%. They also jail hundreds of people without trial. I forget the lady's name, but the woman who was ready to give birth in an Israeli prison a couple of days ago, or maybe she's delivered, I don't know. But she was jailed under legislation from the British era, which simply means you can be jailed because the authorities don't like you. They don't need to present evidence. And these six-month maximum jailings can be rolled over one, two, three, seven, 11 times. And so people live in a lawless situation. It's best to think of it as a situation of complete lawlessness. When a Palestinian approaches an Israeli checkpoint, his or her fate depends entirely upon the mood of an Israeli private or sergeant or whatever, and how that individual feels determines the life chances, the fate of a Palestinian. To have his ID confiscated because the soldier thinks he's impertinent or looks at him in the wrong way, that can wreck his life, can reduce his family from poverty to utter destitution because he loses his job. So the Palestinians live under this regime which is designed to terrorize them into leaving. It's really quite simple at one level, although it's quite sophisticated in its delivery.
Okay. Well, Masood, the regime in Tel Aviv appears to be getting even more aggressive with an increase in trying to depopulate Palestinian areas and convert them into settler areas. I mean, your take on all of this?
Well, Mick is absolutely right, of the picture. But I think we should stop looking at just the this particular clip of what is happening during the last 12 months or last year, This has been going on for the last 70 years, over 70 years. Ethnic cleansing, genocidal act, abuse of individual, creating fear as a tool of controlling masses. It's been going on for a very long time. And we all know that not just those who are in under occupation in Palestine, but indeed even the rest of us in the so-called civilized West, Europe and America and everywhere else, we actually are demonized and, you know, seen as a, identified and promoted as a terrorist or anti-Semite just because we support the right of Palestinians to live as a human being. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, we know from our experience to stand up against the oppressors, there is a price to pay. But the reality is that if we are not all willing to pay that price, united in collective way, then that price becomes much more. It will end up killing people, pregnant women, children, elderly, their houses being demolished. This is happening day in, day out. And indeed, the rest of us need to stand up. We actually have to sort of make this a priority. We cannot have peace in the region without resolving this illegal, oppressive, occupying, sort of illegal occupation and the colonialism. That has to come an end for the region to start moving away from these violence. These violence by the Israeli Zionist state is not just being done by a small group of people. Systematically, youth, Zionist youth, Israeli youth, are actually taught how to hate and how to conflict sort of damage on ordinary Palestinian and continued ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. We need to look at the whole picture. We need to look at what has been going on, not just last year, but for the whole 70 years. And the international community has to take responsibility.
Okay.
Unless that's done, we are going to see more of this, and indeed more people are going to be silent, and then the price for the rest of those who are standing against this operation, it will become much more heavy price to pay.
Well, Mick, young Palestinians are giving their lives on an almost daily basis, trying to free their people from this occupation, and still there is not the major international condemnation that should be taking place. I want you to explain that, especially now that Masoud was just talking about the international community and their need basically to step up to the plate.
Let's talk about two international communities. Let's talk about one, our political elites and corporate elites as well, who tend to be in strong support of Israel. But the Israelis also know very clearly that public opinion is swinging against them massively. And I think we should ask why, when Israel attacked the Palestinians, you know, just a couple of months ago, when the Al-Aqsa Mosque was under threat, when fascist gangs were roving inside 48 and attacking Palestinians, and when families were being thrown onto the street in East Jerusalem. When the resistance in Gaza came to the support of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and fired barrages of rockets into their own land, their own territory called Palestine, which Israel occupies at the moment, it's quite interesting that Israel did not go as far as they did with Operation Protective Edge or Cast Lead. They stopped after a relatively short period, and I'm sorry to say this, after killing only 100 or so Palestinians. Previously, they had killed 1,000 or 2,000 in these terrible massacres, the periodic massacres that they carry out. Why? I think Israel realized that it was headed for a disaster, that this was a political disaster for Israel, and the deep unpopularity that Israel is in public opinion was getting worse and worse and worse. Look, there are two extra dimensions to this I would add to what Masoud says. One is the political tradition in Israel today, which was represented by Netanyahu and by the other dominant groups now, they don't think that they only deserve Palestine. They think that they also deserve Jordan. Their appetites are not restricted to the Jordan River. And the Palestinians, with their blood, and the incredible heroism that you've just mentioned, the fact that these young men and young women continue to resist, they are not just defending Palestine, they're defending the peoples of the entire region. Because the appetites of the Zionists don't stop at the Jordan River. The other dimension that I would add, if I may, is that one of the reasons it's gone on for so long, certainly the last 4 or 5 decades, is that it makes money. That the Palestinians are not only cruelly abused, they are monetized by the Zionist state. Because the weapons, many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan as part of the spending of $2 trillion, which ultimately was unsuccessful, but many of those weapons were tested on Palestinians and then sold by Israel to the USA. So the occupation can be a moneymaker for the Israelis. And it's also a moneymaker in a slightly lesser way. They charge, the Israelis steal most of the aid which is destined for Palestinians as humanitarian aid. And even if you speak to a Palestinian prisoner, you started off talking about the prisoners, if you're a prisoner in the Israeli dungeons, they feed you pig's fill. But if the families pay money, and it's a fair amount of money for their loved ones in these dungeons, they can be given better food. So, no, anything that resembles international law is violated by the Israelis, and mm-hmm. they even abuse the prisoners, not just in terms of cruel torture, which has been researched and shown by many, many bodies, but even at the level of depriving them of decent food, unless that their families cough up extra money.
Okay.
It's blackmail all round. So mm-hmm. yes, Masoud's right, this is a brutal system that's gone on for many, many decades, but it's got a certain grisly stability because of this money-making aspect to it.
Well, Masoud, what does all of this do to the psyche of young Palestinians, especially growing up with this backdrop day in, day out? Checkpoints, apartheid wall, night raids, demolition of homes, not having access to clean water or little electricity. I mean, what does this do to their psyche day in and day out?
Well, they realize, if they haven't realized before, they realize now that the only one they could rely on is themselves. Palestinians have got no other option than to resist this illegal, brutal occupation, this sort of colonial abuses that is taking place day in, day out. And, you know, it takes place despite whatever the Palestinians do. This is an ethnic cleansing systematically in place. And I just want to add one more thing to what Mick was saying, mm-hmm. and that is that Israel needs to create fear among its own citizens to justify this illegal, brutal occupation and this Zionism. And that actually is the need of this state. This state, this illegal state, is in need of conflict. Without conflict, it will not be able to justify its existence. And so, you know, this is going to go on, and Palestinians have got no other option. The real point is what the rest of us are going to do. Are we going to rise up and support the Palestinians? And how far we will go, and do we allow the lobby, the Zionist lobby, what they do in Britain and in United States and elsewhere, what they did with Jeremy Corbyn, what they're doing with the Jewish and sort of pro-Palestinians in Labour Party and elsewhere, do we allow that to continue, or do we all unite and stand together? We are doing a good job, and actually I think we need to do more. We need to realize that, as Mick was saying, their days are outnumbered. The fact of the matter is more ordinary people are seeing the brutality of what's going on for what it is, and this sort of empty propaganda that this Zionist state is the only democracy in the region, it really is such a joke, but most people are waking up to the reality that is not the case, And we need to continue this resistance united and creating a better society and justice society for everyone in the region. And I think that's the way forward.
What about that, Mick? More people are waking up. Your take on that, and is that a sign of actually Israel not no longer being able to totally control the narrative as they have been? And is this a sign of a waning power coming out of Tel Aviv?
It's much better than that. Not only are they unable to control the narrative, they've lost the narrative completely. If you and I are having a discussion, a debate, and it becomes pretty heated and it's very serious, and at a certain point in time I say, don't let her speak, it's because I've lost the argument. If I'm winning the argument, I don't need to silence you. I will carry on winning. Israel wants to silence Massoud, myself, everybody who speaks up for Palestine, without exception, and they want to silence these people because they have lost the argument comprehensively. When we started talking about 20 years ago about Israeli apartheid, we were of lone voices. Very few people would agree with us. And some people who were pro-Palestine said, oh, you're going too far. It's bad, but it's not apartheid. The argument is won. We've won the argument in terms of mainstream, decent, enlightened, and also indifferent public opinion. Israel has lost it. To call Israel an apartheid state, nobody raises an eyebrow. Of course it is. Jewish-only roads, two legal systems, one for Jews and one for Palestinians. It's not a discussion any longer. And you can tell this because Human Rights Watch, not a radical body, or the major Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, has come out openly to say Israel is a system based on Jewish supremacy from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. Not just in the West Bank, but everywhere the Israeli foot falls. So yes, they have lost the argument. The question is, how quickly can we turn this into such action that our elites who are currently selling weapons to Israel will be forced to do what they did with South Africa and abandon a regime whose only crime ever in their eyes will be to fail. You see, the South African regime, the corrupt regime that was ruling in Kabul until recently, the only crime they have that's recognized is failure. But once you fail, then you'll be discarded. We need to turn public opinion into, like gas needs a piston to move, to channel it into effective solidarity. But we don't need to fight for public opinion. Israel's lost that already. The fight is to channel it into BDS activity.
What about that, Master? What does it take to expand this fight? Mick said that the argument has already been won. Now it's a matter of convincing the elites to stop supporting, the political elites to stop supporting that apartheid regime, and also increase pressure from civil society. Tell me, what is it going to take?
Everything, really. BDS, we need to boycott everything Israeli and all the companies who are supporting the State of Israel. And they're extremely scared of this. And but we need to continue it. We need to actually do it religiously. We need to put pressure on the politicians. The politicians in so-called democracies in the West and Europe and the United States are going against the masses. The masses are becoming more pro-Palestinian while the elite and the companies becoming more pro-Israeli. There are reasons for that. Mick mentioned some of it is economy and everything else. But we need to extend our work, and we need to expose every atrocity being committed by this Zionist state, and we need to actually make it as such, like South Africa, that people will be ashamed of supporting and associating with such a regime. When we achieve that, we have actually finally won the whole thing, not just the argument among the civil society. We have gone all the way, and it will be end of this oppressive regime.
And Mick, do you think that we're getting closer to that day?
Who knows? Nobody knows. Nobody predicted a week before that the Berlin Wall would fall. Nobody could predict when the Shah of Iran would fall. You could say he will fall, but nobody could predict the time. It has never possible in a struggle against a brutal regime, it has never been possible to predict the hour or even the year of its fall. It will fall because it's unsustainable. The Palestinians will continue to pay a very, very high price. That price can be lowered by the peoples of the Middle East and the peoples around the world coming to the support of the Palestinians.
Okay, and
but
on
it
that
will continue
note,
to be a cruel struggle.
On that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Scottish, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier of Edinburgh, and from Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajarin, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Last Savior. I have the honor of being joined by our expert, Dr. Murtadha Karimi. Thank you so very much for being with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, sir, for your time. Today, and as always, on The Last Savior, we'll be discussing topics concerning doubts and misconceptions on Mahdawiya, which I think really is a topic that isn't talked about enough. So one of the doubts that could possibly exist in the minds of the people who encounter the topic of Mahdawiya, whether it's today or 1,200 something years back, is that in a lot of people's minds, following an orphan little boy, whether it's an imam or not, might seem as something unlogical, unreasonable, and faulty. And they might have a lot of trouble wrapping their minds around it, and perhaps even rightly so. So if you could be kind enough to explain how to resolve this issue.
This has been mentioned especially by some of the Wahhabi scholars. And this scholar that we are dealing with recently, he claims that, of course, he is true, saying that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was only 5 years old when his father, Imam Askari alayhi salam, was martyred. And Shia believe that from that time onwards, he is the Imam of the Shia. So he says that according to the explicit verses of the Quran and the narrations, he is considered as an orphan, mm-hmm. an orphan child. And according to the verses, when it comes to a